about the first question. Can black holes exist? So the general idea behind this question, again, is black holes are, as we all know, related to singularities. And what they do is excise a part of space-time. So mathematically, they are all right. I mean, they are very nice and so on. But physically, they are somewhat brutal in the sense that you are taking a part out of space-time, and there are singularities in there. So that is the question is, are black holes, that is to say horizons, the geometrical picture, the pure geometrical picture of a black hole, is it just a model of something more, how could I say, it will appear a few times, perhaps the word, dirty physics, instead of it's just a sort of a very compact star, so that the gravitational picture is a wonderful, beautiful, very useful mathematical model and just that, or it is the real thing? So that is, again, the question. Are horizons there, or, yeah. Oh, perfect. Say that again?
I want to understand what you mean by a black hole. If there's not a singularity interior, is it still a black hole? If there's a horizon, say, and what?
I don't know. I mean, what I'm considering is just that the simplest, perhaps spherically symmetric, so in that sense you have singularity. If you have a horizon, there is no singularity in there. Is that a black hole? Well, from the general relativity point of view, it is, right? Yeah, this is what I'm going to talk about. Okay. So this is what you're asking, whether is there any way of regulating singularities and so on?
No, I want to know what you're concerned with. Are you concerned about the role of the horizon, or are you concerned about the singularity?
Mainly the role of the horizon. Okay. But it's not, there is no two-way implications toward the singularity, but it's also, I mean, they're very connected in general, right?
Classic.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. So, yeah, that is one of the issues that is going to be somehow there all the time. So we can go on discussing on that if you feel like that. Okay. So that is one of the issues, that black holes is sort of excising a part of space-time. So that sounds like a bit sort of drastic. So the other issue is black holes emit Hawking radiation. They evaporate. Then what? I mean, this is what is called the information paradox problem. And there is I'm not going to talk much about that. What I'm going to talk a little bit more is about the so-called Transplanckian problem. And this Transplanckian problem has to do with this Hawking evaporation process. And in this process, a very straightforward calculation tells us that there are very high frequencies close to the horizon because of the extreme blue shift appearing there. And that factor depends on which numbers you put in there, but if it's not 79, it will be 40 or whatever. And it comes just from a very big gravitational factor, which is exponential of the surface gravity times the lifetime of the black hole. And that exponential is very fast. And then you get ultra high frequencies at the horizon that are redshifted towards infinity. So if Hawking, the calculation for Hawking radiation involves all this high energy physics, can it be trusted? Because obviously, nobody expects that, perhaps as Lee was saying, that a quantum field theory in curves of space-time is going to be valid up to arbitrary high frequencies. So there are different options. First, who cares? I take quantum field theory as it is now seriously and forget about everything else. And that's it. We don't know quantum theory of gravity. We go all the way. I don't think that's very acceptable. So there are other options, for instance, introducing modifications in the high energy theory that will lead to some modifications in the effective field theory that is living in our effective curve background. So now the question is if Hawking radiation depends so strongly on these high energy regimes and we change the high energy physics, is Hawking radiation going to survive when we introduce these modifications? That is one question. That is the one that people have been addressing. But the point that I'm going to point out is that, okay, if we introduce these modifications just to sort of regularize this behavior of Hawking radiation, how do these modifications affect black holes? So you have to have a look at the whole picture. You cannot just try to solve one problem, forget everything else, because perhaps this modification is changing the whole picture of black hole altogether. Okay. So a specific way of introducing these high energy theories is just introducing effective dispersion relations in standard field theory. So the idea, again, is if we have a high energy theory, an underlying high energy theory, we can have two sort of, I'm just trying to classify it in a very straightforward way. Either situations in which the horizons are preserved, this would be, for instance, provided by what we call subluminal effective field theories. That would mean that the dispersion relation would not be omega squared k squared, but something that is changed, some additional terms to this k squared part. But at any rate, the group velocity will be smaller than c. So that is what I call superluminal. So there's a change in the dispersion relation, but nothing can escape from the horizon still. Okay? And the other possible, possibility is that horizons are erased and are kept only as a very low, long wavelength approximation. Okay? So you have an effective metric in that situation. So that is, for instance, but described by superluminal effective field theories in which to the omega squared equal k squared dispersion relation, you add something so that the group velocity can be larger than the speed of sound, than the speed of light. But as I said before, if you introduce these sort of modifications to deal with this very high frequency behavior of the Hawking radiation, you have to make sure that the whole scenario is consistent, because it might happen that something sort of special. It's sort of clear that, for instance, here that you are erasing the horizon and you're changing the whole thing, the whole picture, very importantly. So let me talk a little bit about these two possibilities. Superluminal dispersion. An example of such superluminal dispersion is that one there, adding a k fourth term over kappa Planck. I said whatever I said is subluminal. I said super. Okay, obviously it's subluminal. Thank you. Sub. Okay. So anyway, it's omega squared k squared minus k fourth over some scale. That is clearly something that if you calculate the derivative of omega with respect to k, you will obtain some subluminal behavior always, okay, with speed of your propagation signal smaller than the speed of light. Horizons are still present, so nothing can escape from there. So no big change there. Hawking radiation is still preserved via different it's via what is called mode conversion. People in condensed matter physics call it Andreev reflection. And I'm not going to get into the details, but as you can see with this dispersion relation, what you get you get some extra mode. So you have modes that have the non-trivial dynamics generated by this dispersion relation mixes them at the horizon, and so you can get this Hawking radiation or this radiation. So anyway, the point is that all that we had before, singularities and every other problems that we had with the horizons are still present. So there is no big change. And there is also, this final issue is slightly different, in nature. But if I have to introduce these sort of modifications, the point is, am I going to be able to distinguish between them, or are these just some artifacts that I'm introducing to cure this ultraviolet behavior of Hawking radiation, but I'm not going to be able to check them? Well, it's quite easy to see that if you need, it's a scale. If you want to explore this high energy physics, you want to explore the physics of Hawking evaporation, but the lifetime is huge, so there is no point in knowing whether these dispersion relations have any physical meaning or is just a way of theoretically curing things, but you're not going to say that. So these subluminal dispersion relations essentially do not change much apart from curing the calculation of Hawking radiation. What is happening with a superluminal? Now I'm saying this correctly. So adding, instead of subtracting, for instance, that term. Why am I considering only the k fourth terms? Well, obviously this is just an expansion, so you can take models, and this is just the next correction. Okay, this is what I'm considering. So here you can see that horizons are blurred. This means that The concept of horizon is only valid for sufficiently long wavelengths, so small k, and you can ignore the other part. Because otherwise, here there is always some leaking of some leakage of signals from the inside. Now, horizon is no longer a well-defined theory here, or a well-defined object here. Okay, so high wave number signals can escape. That is first, and now we have this concept or this general sort of idea that why are within the context of general relativity singularities, why are they formed? Well, they are formed because a horizon is something like everything that enters cannot get out. But here, if that is not true any longer, because we can have signals that are coming out, the concept of forming a singularity, they are having sort of an arbitrary high density inside, is no longer sort of compulsory once you have a black hole. Okay, so things can get out, so there is no need just to get an infinite packing of things inside. So in this context, the opposite idea seems more compelling. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying that perhaps there is no need for forming the singularity. So in this situation, you sort of are eliminating all these horizons. There are no black holes anymore. What is happening in the strict sense, I mean? So what is happening with Hawking radiation? Well, the same thing that we were having before, just that we have modes inside, we have modes outside, I'm partial. You have to couple them, and in this coupling, you get some extra bits that can be understood as radiation. So now the point is, that's OK, but how does it affect the whole picture? And the problem with that is that now the interior is like a box, OK? And it's like a box with a slight leakage. So this means that there can be resonances that end up leaking. And so there are instabilities in this system. So how do these instabilities behave? Are they very bad or not that bad? Well, there is what I'm calling the Planck scale instability, meta-stability. This means that instabilities that appear there are sufficiently long-lived as compared with the Planck scale. Okay. And I say, well, OK, in this scale, it's OK. What is the meaning of this? Well, what I'm meaning or what I'm thinking when I'm saying that is, for instance, that you can build this analog of black holes, acoustic black holes, in fluids or in condensates or whatever. And there, the role of the Planck scale is played for what is called the healing length. Without entering into details, it is related to the space between atoms in your fluid. And now I'm considering these acoustic analogs in which you have a flow. Whenever the flow is subsonic, sound can travel both ways. When it is supersonic, the flow drags the sound, and so we are dealing with these analogies. And there, what you see is that those systems will emit the sound radiation, the sonic radiation, and that is metastable, provided that you are considering holes that are of the order or larger than this healing length, this characteristic length of the system. Larger, significantly larger, but not huge. So you have metastability. But now, if we take the same trick, and we take it to astrophysics and consider a large black hole, what you will see is that those instabilities are very long-lived as compared with the characteristic scale of the system, well, the fundamental scale of the system, Planck's length or Planck's time, so they are the order of microseconds. But, of course, that is nothing as compared with the lifetime of the star. So these are extremely unstable, astrophysically speaking. Okay. So, just a second. So if I'm considering superluminal dispersion relation, it seems that these modifications would spoil the whole idea of black holes altogether, of horizons altogether, because they would make them unstable. So they would prevent the formation of these horizons. Yeah. You were saying something? Or? No, sorry. I thought you were asking a question. So superluminal dispersion relations seem to cure this problem, this ultraviolet divergences in the Hawking radiation. But makes the whole black hole scenario ill-defined in the sense that they are not stable. So so much for can black holes exist? I mean, as you can see, it's just a few ideas hinting that perhaps black holes have serious difficulties. Are black holes necessary? So in other words, are they inevitable in the sense that when I have gravitational collapse, a black hole is formed? In classical general relativity, no doubt. We all know that. And what is happening in semi-classical gravity, without even going to whatever theory of quantum gravity? What is happening in semi-classical gravity? In semi-classical gravity, perhaps not. What do I mean by perhaps not? Well, the idea, again, is that what might be happening is that just because close to the horizon, there is a high vacuum polarization that could stop. I mean, if that is immensely huge, that could stop the collapse. But we have this theorem, the Fulling-Sweeney-Wall theorem, that is telling us that in gravitational collapse, the renormalized stressed energy tensor is always finite. Okay? So it doesn't prevent it from being large, very large. And of course, it's vacuum polarization. It will be violating energy conditions. So this means that it will exert a pressure towards the outside. And perhaps that finite but large energy momentum tensor of the vacuum polarization close to the horizon might be able to compensate the collapse of the matter that is falling down. So in view of these ideas, perhaps other smoother, not so violent options as compared to horizons might exist that have no singularities and no long-lasting horizons. So in this sense, in the literature, there are various models for this sort of objects that mimic the behavior of black hole without actually being them. Here I'm naming perhaps the most popular, boson condensate stars by Chaplin, Laughlin, and so on, Mazur, Motola, also gravastars, or the proposals made by Barceló, Visser, and Liberati, and other people that are sort of ultra-compact stars made out of regular standard matter, but very, very compressed. So I don't want to get into the details of each model. I'm going to call them generically black stars. And the feature, the characteristic that I want to keep in mind is that these black stars are almost black holes, but not quite. They are very, very compact. The size is very close to the Schwarzschild radius in spherical symmetry, but not quite. Okay? That is the kind of objects that I want to consider a little bit now.
Larger than the upper mass limit for neutron star starts to collapse, and some vacuum polarization energy is enough to block it?
Or maybe not, but yes, that is the idea that's behind all this.
And does this require, is this requiring the superluminal modifications of quantum field theory?
No. As I was telling you, this is sort of punching. I was just first pointing out can I cure black hole radiation, Hawking radiation? Keeping the black hole scenario. And so I was pointing out that perhaps there are difficulties, and when you modify your theories to make Hawking radiation consistent, then the whole thing blows up. So that is one. And now I'm trying to see whether for whatever procedure there is a change in the collapse process.
So neutron stars are less than order of magnitude off the Schwarzschild radius. So should you see effects in neutron star equation of state if you're, you know, within order of magnitude of the part where your vacuum polarization starts to change?
I don't think so. We did also some back of the envelope calculations, and for those they are very, very tiny. I mean, when I'm saying close to forming a horizon, it's just really, really very close.
And you need to have some equations to estimate. So I mean, you haven't given us any equations. So
I mean, yeah, I'm not trying to give you the details, but there are equations there. You can have a look at some.
So what are the equations? What what type of equations?
Say that again?
What are the equations? I mean, what sort of equations do you solve for this black star?
Well, you just take, you calculate what is the normalized energy momentum sensor when you have some system that is collapsing and how it is building the whole vacuum polarization there. So it's just field theory calculations of the stress energy momentum tensor. It's the same sort of calculations, actually they're very close, to the ones that you do when you calculate the Unruh vacuum and the Wolver vacuum and so on. So then, for instance, it's the same thing as in the Sweeney pulling and Wolf theory. What you do is you start with some vacuum and you see that if you start in the past with a regular vacuum, it will have a mark of that condition quantum force in the vacuum, it will evolve regularly. So this is what the theorem says in the end. So you can calculate those things.
But I mean, if you do calculate these things in the nice slicing of a space-time that go through the horizon regularly, nothing really blows up. So
this is what the theorem says, right?
So how would you stop?
No. What you can check, in particular, Visser, Buffalo, and so on, checked very carefully, is that that energy momentum tensor there close to the horizon can be very large. Not infinite, but can be very large.
Even in the nicest slicing, that.
I'm going to that because with those calculations, what they saw, for instance, is that if the shell is free falling, there is no way of stopping the collapse because the energy momentum tensor is not large enough there.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is not close to free falling, so it goes sort of slower, then there is a possibility that the energy momentum tensor builds up. So it depends on the way on which the whole thing collapses. And this is just standard field theory calculations. Okay. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about these black stars. So black stars are, as I was saying, the idea is that they are just quasi-black holes. Okay, in the sense that it's just a star that is very, very close to the horizon. So how could this be formed? Well, which scenarios? Well, there are various scenarios that would allow perhaps for these sort of things. One of them is, although I don't know much about this, so I'm not saying anything, it's asymptotically safe gravity. So we have these kind of theories that switch gravity off as you go to high energies. This also may be motivated by some condensed matter analog models. And of course, what would be happening is just that as the matter is collapsing, it's getting denser and denser. At some point, because of this procedure switching off in these theories of gravity, then they would become just standard fields in flat space-time or whatever. And so they would just scatter in a standard way. It would go out and again collapse because of gravitational when the gravitational interaction is switched on again because the density is not so high, and via some dissipation, it might sort of go to some equilibrium situation. Okay, so that is a possibility and specific possibility in which these things could happen. And now the question is: these black stars, these sort of quasi-black holes, will emit Hawking radiation or not? So what you can do is to calculate. Imagine you have this star, and you have that star sort of in equilibrium very close to the horizon. And of course, it's oscillating around its equilibrium position slightly. So that oscillation, of course, is a dynamics that is producing particles. And these particles are energy. And this energy can be redshifted. And in practice, what you see is that it is indistinguishable from Hawking radiation. So the answer is yes, except that now it is not because, I mean, Hawking radiation is not produced because the star is collapsing, going towards the horizon and never stopping, so that the dynamics close to the horizon is frozen. Instead, that is an infinitely, permanently going on dynamics, and that is producing the particles of Hawking radiation. But rather, it is because there are some oscillations close to the horizon like that. Okay, so. Also, Abreu and collaborators showed that if you have a star, a very, very compact star, The entropy law, again, follows something, the standard ordinary matter entropy of that star follows asymptotically very, very closely the area law of black hole dynamics, of black hole thermodynamics. So the entropy of a very, very dense, very close to horizon is very, very, very close to A over 4. So that is the other issue. And now, yeah, but it's again the same thing. I mean, it's the being close, very, very close to the horizon. It is that it's what makes the matter there have an equation of state that is very close to stiff matter. You cannot go beyond just because of the speed of sound there gets higher than the speed of light. But it is that ultra compact situation that gives you. I can give you the intercept ones if you want. But you can establish the. This was done in a couple of papers, a PRL and a Journal of High Energy Physics, if I remember correctly, of 2010 and 11, probably. I can give you the references afterwards, in which they compute these bounds, and these bounds, these bounds, and what they see is that what they get is first very, very dense matter in this, well, with this very rarefied equation of state, and the bound is A over 4. So now there is no Transplanckian problem. Why is that so? Because that very, very high redshift was because of this exponential behavior taking to very large values very close to the horizon. But as soon as you are not that far, I mean, you are very close, but not arbitrarily close to the horizon, kills that double exponential. And so you get values, I mean, that approximately doesn't matter whether it's 10 to minus 3 or 1. It's just they are sort of reasonable, OK? And I will give you the trivial calculation that is behind this sort of a no Transplanckian problem in a minute. So now, if we have no singularity, because we have just a very dense star but no singularity, we have no information problem. What we're doing with this possibility is, as I said before, substituting the whole geometric picture for a black hole or for one of these ultra compact objects by simply very real, well, not every day, obviously, because the matter seems to be very weird, but it's just matter, dirty physics in the sense of not geometry, just fields, okay? One other issue is, okay, you are talking about comparing black holes and behaviors and so on with these substitutes, which are black stars. They behave very similarly, and but can I differentiate? Can I tell? Well, we're dealing with this and not with that, and at least from a fundamental point of view. And the answer is yes. For instance, in a thought experiment, you can take a radar echo, a signal sent towards the star, and wait for the echo. So, I mean, this is a trivial calculation, but it gives you an idea of what is happening. So, what is the time for the signal to bounce back to you? It's clear that it's going to be twice the time that it gets to go from R0, which is where I am, to RS, which is the surface of the star, okay? And it is given by this, and here we have it. This part here, R0 minus RS, is just the standard without any gravity time that it takes to go there and come back. And this part is the gravitational delay. So if I take some very well-known simple numbers, for instance, I take the Schwarzschild radius of the sun, or very close to it, R0, I take it sort of light, 8 light minutes from the sun, from that ultra-compact star. That is obviously, if we were substituting the sun by this very compact star, I was in the Earth, I was sending signals. This is the 8 light minutes. And the radius of the star is not the Schwarzschild radius, but it is the Schwarzschild radius plus some ridiculously small, just for the sake of giving you an example, which is 10 to the minus 40 Planck lengths. I mean, if you put here 1 or 10, it is even more drastic. So you put the numbers, and what you get is that the time is just 16 light minutes, which is obviously just the standard time, plus 4 milliseconds, which is much, much smaller than the infinite time that it would require for a black hole. Because if you have the signal, it will go through and you will never get it. And I want to point out that the difference between these 4 milliseconds and the infinite time that is because of this logarithm that is actually killing all these minors. I mean, this is tiny, but it is the logarithm that is changing everything. And this is what is behind also the solution of the Trans-Planckian problem with when you have a very compact star very close to the formation of the horizon, but not quite being in the horizon. So it's sort of the trivial calculation that is giving you these numbers that are making a clear difference from, for both stars. So finally, I want to comment briefly on this section is called possible route to black star formation. Actually, I'm not sure it's a route or anything. It's again, it's just a few comments of the possibility, again, without calculations in this sense, because this is what I would like to have, to see a dynamical situation in which the collapse actually stops. If I had that, I would be telling about that and not obviously about hints, let's say. So you're right in a sense, but not in the sense I was saying before. So what I'm going to do is to see, to try to think about this possible route with, of course, lots of spice there, to see how this could happen. And to do that, what I'm going to do is to consider a very simple situation. I'm going to ask the following question. I have a black hole. Now, I don't care whether it's a black star or a black hole. I have something that is emitting radiation. So if I'm at infinity, I know what I'm perceiving. I'm getting Hawking radiation. We all know that. Now, the point is, if I have a different observer that has certain trajectory, what will he or she see? That is the question. What does an observer with an arbitrary trajectory observe? So to solve this problem, what we did is just consider a reduced or simplified version. Instead of calculating, which is the next step, calculating the full energy momentum tensor, what we did is just calculate the temperature whenever there is a temperature. And if it is not a temperature, it will be something that will be indicating how strong the whole radiation is. I will give you the details in a moment. So what I'm doing is first introducing this U bar. These U bar coordinates are just the Schwarzschild outgoing coordinates. So these are going to be for reference. I'm taking those coordinates just because are the ones I'm used to. I'm going to take capital U, which is the coordinate that is used to define the modes that define the vacuum. For instance, if I'm considering the Unruh vacuum, which is the one that I will have in a black hole, and it will be sort of exponential. Of course, there are some things that are missing, but the important part is the exponential relation between the Schwarzschild coordinate U bar and the capital U. So that U modes we defined in terms of that U are giving us the Unruh vacuum. And I'm going to consider one more coordinate, which are the other one that is relevant, is that now I have an observer. So I'm going to consider its proper time. And of course, I want to know this small u, and I want to know what will he see. We know that what he will see is encoded in the relation between both times, OK? At least in some approximation. And now the point is, how do I extract that information from here? So what we're going to do is to define this function kappa, which is the second derivative of the relation between the time that is defined in the vacuum and the one that is that of the observer that I'm considering. And I'm going to divide it by p dot. So that thing there is giving us an idea of how trajectories of one and the other are separating. Okay, and why am I doing this? Well, if I integrate this equation, this means that I can get this expression in terms of this kappa that is dependent, of course, on time with the integral of the exponential of the integral of kappa. And what is happening when kappa, this function, is constant? When this function is constant, it goes to this exponential relation, and then we get the well-known Planckian spectrum. And if it is not constant, well, this is no longer valid. But if it is almost constant, and you can quantify that in a very specific and clear way, so if kappa changes slowly with time, This will be still a good approximation, and you will get something that is Planckian with a temperature that is changing slowly in time. And if it is not changing slowly in time, then you will not get any Planckian spectrum or anything. But still, you can get an idea of what, of how strong or how many particles are you getting, and so on. So you have an idea of, I mean, this is just an indicator somehow, a temperature-like indicator of the radiation that this observer is seeing. So this is what we are using. And you can do the calculations. And now you take a trajectory. So you take the Unruh vacuum, for instance. So you have a black hole, and then you have some observer that is moving radially towards the horizon or whatever. Now the question is, what will he see? What kappa is the one that he will be suffering, let's say, in this sense? Well, you can do the calculation, and you get this result. This kappa is determined by the local features of the observer, of the detector that I have there. Well, it's just an observer, so, which is just the position, its speed, and its acceleration. Okay? In what sense or in what specific form does it appear there? So it appears in the following way. This kappa V that I have, I think this is the first time in my life since I was 10 or something that I'm using one of these things. Okay? So this kappa V is just, if you are in the Unruh vacuum, is 1 over 4m. So that's it. M, obviously, is the mass of your black hole. R is the position in which your observer is. This V is the speed, but it's the speed as compared to the black hole as seen by an inertial observer. And this A is just the proper acceleration. This G is just the gravitational factor shift that we know. And this D is just a Doppler shift. So what we see here, and of course all quantities depend on the trajectory. Okay, this will depend on this A, R, and so on, will depend on the trajectory. So now the question is, imagine you take the Unruh observer. The Unruh observer, the one in terms of, I mean, that will see nothing, will not see any particles, is which one? Well, you can check that it is that that has zero velocity, zero speed at the horizon and is free falling. That is the one. So if you do that, what you will see is that this thing at the horizon goes to zero, right? And that's it. But now the point is, if I have a free falling observer, what will he see? And if you don't think twice, you will say, well, it's zero. He will see nothing. But that's not quite true, because for that observer, it's true that just when he reaches the horizon, it will be zero. This will be zero. But this part here is not, because the speed of that observer, as compared with the light, is precisely one, or minus one, because it goes inside. And this Doppler shift becomes infinite. And so this infinite compensates this zero, and a free-falling observer will see, when he crosses the horizon, a radiation which, with temperature, is, let me say, temperature, effective temperature, or this indicator, equal to 1 over 4m. 1 over m, four times the temperature that will be seen by an observer at infinity. And it is not a temperature in the sense that this kappa is changing there at the horizon, not too fast, not too fast. So if the condition is that kappa, it's not exactly that, because you have to introduce the proper dimensions. But if it is that kappa dot must be much smaller than one, then there you see that this kappa dot is actually like 0.5 or 0.7. So it's not very small, but it's small enough so that you can have an idea that it will be a deformation of the Planckian spectrum. Okay. So that is, for instance, the situation. And of course, what we are seeing is that a free-falling observer will see radiation, will see radiation. So, and it gets worse if the observer is not free-falling, but it goes slower, okay? So the slower it goes, the higher the radiation he's going to see. So that is the idea that I want to point out. And that is, you can all get, you can take that calculation and put all the data that you want for all possible situations, and you get the different perceptions of the different observers. So now, what is happening? That of course there is a balance between the energy emitted by Hawking's radiation. It has to come from somewhere. So these amounts, as just a way of saying it, calculating the energy momentum tensor, at the close to the horizon, that there is an negative energy there at the horizon, which is the deficit because of the radiation that has been emitted. And so this is the one that may be exerting a pressure, introducing some kind of buoyancy or something, that might be able to stop the collapse if you are not starting as free fall, which is what is usually happening. You can start with some slower procedure just because of interaction with matter. Or,
essentially, pressure of Hawking radiation.
But close to the horizon is high, or maybe.
No, you said it's T. You see, it doesn't diverge. You said it's T. It's Hawking, right? It's
but it can be very large.
What do you mean by very large? I mean,
you can get
4 times Hawking temperature.
No. That is for a free falling observer.
Yeah.
But for instance, you can take the opposite. As you well know, if you take an observer that is very close to the horizon, it would suffer a very, I mean, that is constant, it's stationary, static there, it would suffer a very high.
Sure, but
and
but
something the, between would be large.
No, but the question is, what keeps the observer next to the horizon? So you need like a very exotic type of matter to keep the observer there. That's, otherwise it's going to just fall in. That's
no, hold on. What are you saying? What is the... what kind of engines do I need to keep it there? No, that I agree. But the picture I want to transmit is the following: free falling observers see tiny but non vanishing. Okay, tiny. And if I, for whatever reason, I have a static observer that will see that person will see a lot. And now the question is: if I have an observer that is falling, and for whatever reason does not start free falling, for instance, starts slowly. So as it goes towards the horizon, he will be much slower because of his engines or whatever will be much slower. So than free fall, so will be accelerated in that sense, and will suffer the radiation. And again, the higher the radiation that he sees, probably he will slower more and more, and obviously higher and slower and higher and slower. And the question is whether that is enough or not. But the vacuum polarization there can be very high.
But I mean, it just seems to me you're assuming what you need, like that to get the right what result that you want.
No.
That because the thing is that to put something at the horizon to stop the observer is already putting there what you want, which is something other than a black hole. So, I mean, that...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, then, let me rephrase the whole thing. You take a shell of matter, or just a real cloud, okay?
Yeah.
So, it starts falling. It doesn't fall free fall. I mean, each of the components
sure.
doesn't go free fall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, is that difference enough or not? Because they do not start free falling. Actually, they start slower. And the whole interaction between matter can slow things down. So is that enough? I mean, in the end, this is the question that I have no answers, obviously, but I hope we will have some. But I'm not sure now. So the point is that enough to start sort of, so that the collapse starts in a slow enough state of motion so that the whole, how to say, exponential behavior of slowing down takes place or not. So I just want to point out that it might be just because of that. And if we knew, I mean, if the fully swinging wall theorem were not there and infinities could build up, then we would know that actually that would be the case, because you would not get infinity. At some point you would stop to prevent that infinity. But this theorem tells us it cannot be infinity. It doesn't mean that this vacuum this vacuum polarization cannot build up to high values enough or not. Okay, so But anyway, I mean, yeah, I'm just trying to point as a whole context of research in which we are trying to get results and giving you partial ones and so on. So it's, I agree with you in the sense that it's just a mixture of the results that we have and the results that we that are saying, well, can we get this or not? So I already said what is in here. So the idea is that if we start, and I repeat, I said already, we start sort of slower than freefall. Is that slower building vacuum polarization that will stop the motion further, and then it will build up more vacuum polarization that will stop the, will decrease, will decelerate the system further, and so on. So this is it. This is what I want to tell you. I'm finishing just with a summary. And the summary is repeating what I said in the beginning. What I've been talking about is the question, is the final stage of gravitational collapse a black hole or not? And what I've been doing is that giving some patchy arguments or some patchy ideas on the difficulties, some of the difficulties that the black hole scenario may present, the issue of comparing classical versus semi-classical gravitational collapse we've been discussing right now, and this other possibility that if there are no black holes, actually there are something that look very much like that, which is the final stage of collapse. It might well be that this final stage is not a geometrical excision of space-time, but just a very compact matter and star, okay? So this is why the to be or not to be, that is the question, because as you can see, it's not that I have the answer, I just have questions, and some of them are sort of I've been trying just to give hints or what perhaps I would like to get or I could get, and the possible ways of checking whether these are options or not. So thank you very much. This is what I wanted to say.
Time for questions now, for comments.
Somebody else? Does your black star have a positive or negative heat capacity?
Say that again?
I mean, the heat capacity of the black star?
It should have, but I haven't done, I mean, I don't know. It should have, but it hasn't done it.
Well, what I think is, I mean, normally a gravitational system, the heat capacity is negative.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You now you see the black star is very close to the horizon, in the horizon. And if there's some accretion towards it,
mm-hmm.
falling towards it, I mean, it should heat it up. And then, it should not get heated up. Because it's negative heat capacity, it should contract a little bit. And then just fall under the smaller than the event horizon.
Yeah, but here there is an extra bit that is playing a, if it does, is playing a fundamental role, which is the negative energy of the vacuum polarization that is exerting additional pressures to the ones that you are talking about that would stop the whole thing, and that would contribute to that problem.
So what is this? It's the more or less you have a then the radiation from the accretion is a very high efficiency?
I guess you could say that. I guess that is a way of saying that. But I haven't thought about the heat capacity of this issue, so I would have to say that and actually compare the terms. But I would say that the answer is to your last question. Or the, last way in which you had the question is yes, it should be sufficiently high efficiency so within these scenarios to stop.
So I think it's a little bit related. You said that the entropy of the black star is very close to the entropy of the black hole.
Yeah.
Right? What is the equation of state of the black star?
It is what I told you, I guess. It ends up being stiff matter, so it's equal, it's
zero.
Is W equals to
one.
So is this the solution by Don Page and Zurek? Because they have a paper of that sort, but they have a naked singularity at the center. So is that what you're talking about?
No, I don't think so.
And Tuft also has a similar.
No, I don't think so. But probably I don't remember, but I think they have that equation to this one.
They have the same equation, but your solution is different, the one that you're
I think so. Except that I have no solution.
Ah, so then what?
Okay. So I haven't been able to derive the final stage.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I was telling you. And
but even at a static level, I mean, so is your claim is that just statically, if you have a stiff fluid, you can find a solution?
Perhaps a way of seeing to the whole thing might be something the analog of isothermal spheres. So
mm-hmm.
that you have in every layer, you have a density profile that is just such that you keep the whole thing on the verge of collapsing, but not quite, in every layer of the star.
So, are there any astrophysics? Do you have any observables?
No.
So there, you can't see from AGN, for example.
No. Actually, as you can, probably you've noticed, the only experimental test, let me put in quotation marks, that I was putting here just to distinguish between these two situations is something very ideal, in the sense that you're sending a signal. I mean, it's fundamental, but I don't think from the astrophysical point of view.
You said that somebody measured the entropy.
No. Somebody calculated.
All right.
As people calculate black hole entropy. Okay. So no. Yes.
I want to come back because I'm also very puzzled about why there would be no astrophysics. For example, Avery Broderick here had as part of a collaboration to image the horizon of the black hole in Sagittarius or
mm-hmm.
in Andromeda.
Yes.
And see the fact that there is a horizon there that from a cutoff on the. Actually, I don't remember how it's done.
It's actually, I mean. The result is much more strong than just seeing. So the result is that if anything, if there is a surface anywhere outside the horizon, then when a star hit that surface, then they should get out, basically. So, and the fact that we see a stuff going in but nothing coming out puts a strong constraint on what sort of a surface you could have.
Oh, okay.
Like, for example, what you were describing, that's already ruled out if you want to send a radar to the surface and see it back. Because so you want to assume perfect reflection or something like that. I mean, that's how radar thinks. You want some signal to be reflected. But the fact is that there are astrophysical objects where you see significant, a lot of stuff accreting into it, but nothing coming out. And that already says that it needs to be a very, very special type of surface, which I mean, it's very, very well maybe because, I mean, it's not regular matter that you put there. But yes, the surface needs to be a very, absorbing surface. It should absorb like 99.9% of whatever that gets in. So chances are that the radar cannot get anything out of it. but
just because of absorption by matter, even if it's only...
Well, we don't know. I mean, just this is observational constraint.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I understand why you're puzzled. I understand very well why you're puzzled and what you're worried about. But intuitively, I don't understand why you have confidence in the solution. So let me try to. And then it's related to the fact that black holes are astrophysically accessible, and they're also close to neutron stars, which are very astrophysically accessible.
Yes.
So let me try it this way. I mean, we believe that there are black holes on the order of a few solar masses. I mean, the upper mass limit of the neutron stars is
yes.
a few solar masses. So above that, to 8-10 solar masses, there should be lots of black holes. We also know that there are black holes, that you could call them black hole like that.
No, that's fine. I mean, I understand.
of a million to 100 million solar masses.
Yes.
And so this is a huge range of scales.
Yes.
Okay. You want to postulate some physics that over this huge range of scales is stable, stops the collapse, and doesn't have any, doesn't mess up the physics of neutron stars.
I understand the problem. Yes, I understand.
And I'm just wondering where, especially if you're hovering right over the horizon, why, if this physics comes from quantum field theory doesn't have a G in it, But why is this physics so exquisitely smart and wise that even without knowing what G is, it can balance something just infinitesimally above where the horizon would be, because where the horizon would be knows what G is. And where the horizon would be is not a local thing. It is, you know, this equivalence principle. It's not something locally happening that says, hey guys, I'm pointing to a horizon.
Uh-huh.
So your quantum field physics has to know something very non-local about to stop the collapse just before the horizon. It has to do it over a broad range of scales, and has to do it without having G anywhere in its
physics. Well, the G would be there through back reaction, right?
Okay, so that's fair. What about the other?
No, the other I have no answer.
Okay, one out of three. So I mean, what's so terrible about the idea that there are places that we can't see?
Sorry, but okay, but if I understood correctly, what you're saying is that the kind of things I'm proposing, what I'm talking about here, should work in a wide range of scales. Is that correct?
And they should be stable. So you hit this black hole with something from an accretion disk, and it shakes a little bit, and it doesn't go inside the horizon sometimes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if your epsilon, where epsilon is really tiny,
yes,
above the point where you crash to the horizon, and then you hit the thing with a rock coming from the accretion disk, or something, it's not going to oscillate your surface in such a way that this is what's really your question about the equation of state. It has to be so exquisite but so powerful. It seems to me much more likely that we just have the crisis, that horizons, at least apparent horizon. I don't know that I have to believe in global horizons,
yes,
but that trapped surfaces really exist in nature, and we have to think about the consequences. Anyway, this is just
a
reaction.
Sure, sure, sure. And answering this question, and answering your last one, why am I so bothered about this, is I don't think the problem, at least for me, is a question of, well, you've got black holes there, so what's the problem? I find it a bit disturbing, this idea that I was pointing out in the beginning, that is sort of you are excising a part, cutting a part of space-time out of your continuum, right? So I find it sort of too drastic.
I'm sorry to dominate the discussion, but this is how this went. It's not something that exists, you're cutting out the space-time, which is being, quote, cut out is to the future. So you're altering the future, but we're always altering the future. It's not as if somebody came into something that exists statically with a knife and did surgery on it.
Well, I mean, just to respond to what you said, I mean, this would be, I guess, the point of view that maybe what you might want to take is, I mean, if you believe in this superluminal UV completion of the theories for whatever reason that you have, maybe your reason is something like Kojava's, that it's, if you want to have a quantum renormalizable quantum graph, if you even do that, then you don't have the option of exciting any region of the space-time, because whatever happens in that region is going to affect regions outside of it. So your theory, the fact that it becomes unpredictable inside the horizon, it means it's become unpredictable outside the horizon. So, and there are no trapped surfaces, basically, because there is no maximum speed. So, I mean, that would be the reason, I would say.
But that, yeah. But that is inside, not a specific, but in a specific family of high energy theories, let's say.
I just wanted to put in 2 cents on Lee's comment about the wide range of scales. There are two distinct populations of black holes that we see. There are astrophysical ones of the order of a few solar masses, and then there are the ones in galactic cores. Right, there are two disjoint populations. There don't seem to be masses in the mid-range. There don't seem to be microscopic black holes. So if we're going to start coming up with theories for things that mimic black holes but are not black holes, I don't see an a priori reason why we have to think these are the same type of object. Right, we could have one alternative theory for astrophysical-sized black holes and another alternative theory for the ones that are the cores of galaxies like the Sagittarius object.
The gap is not that large, is it?
Pardon?
The gap is not that large.
Well, I mean, it's a difference between, I think astrophysical ones go up to about 20 solar masses, and ones in the core of galaxies start at about 1 million solar masses. It's quite a big gap.
Well, the question is, what's the measure? What's the right metric in this space?
I don't know. I mean, personally, I don't have a problem with the idea of horizons, right? Yeah. I'm just picking up on Lee's point.
Yeah.